The point is that you have to work. And that's why the propaganda system is so successful. Very few people are going to have the time or the energy or the commitment to carry out the constant battle that's required to get outside of, McNeely or Dan Rather or somebody like that. The easy thing to do, you come home from work, you're tired, you've had a busy day, you're not going to spend the evening carrying out a research project. So you turn on the tube and say, it's probably right. So you look at the headlines in the paper and then you watch the sports or something. That's basically the way the system of indoctrination works. Sure, the other stuff is there, but you're going to have to work to find it.
From the book, Doublespeak by William Lutz. Page 164. How to Bake a Fruitcake, Pentagon Style. When Christmas comes, can fruitcake be far behind? Now, you might pick up a fruitcake or two at the supermarket while doing your Christmas shopping and let it go at that. Or if you're real ambitious, you might even bake your own fruitcake. But if you're the military, you don't go to the grocery store, and you certainly don't bake your own fruitcake. Instead, you cook up some specifications for fruitcake. 18 pages of specifications, complete with charts, cross-references to other publications, and 4 pages of amendments. Even the most elaborate recipe for fruitcake in all of my cookbooks doesn't cover one whole page. So how could those guys at the Army's Research, Development, and Engineering Command come up with 18 pages of small type listing all of the specifications for making a military fruitcake? Well, here's just some of Grandma Pentagon's recipe for an approved fruitcake. Military Specification MIL-F-1499F, amended 1980, calls for candied orange peel, quote, thoroughly deragged and processed with sugar and corn syrup to not less than 72% soluble solids, unquote. Grandma Pentagon's recipe also includes instructions to soak raisins, quote, as necessary to prevent clumping. To dice the candied pineapple into quarter-inch chunks, to use candied cherries made from pitted cherries cut to yield quarter-inch to half-inch pieces, to use nuts of the latest crop, and shortening with the stability of not less than 100 hours, vanilla flavoring shall be pure or artificial vanilla in such quantities that its presence shall be organoleptically detected, but not to a pronounced degree, unquote. And then the author says parenthetically, that means you have to use enough vanilla to taste or smell it, but not so much that it overpowers the fruitcake. The Pentagon continues, the fruitcake batter shall consist of equal parts by weight of cake batter specified in Table 1 and fruit and nut blend specified in Table 2, blended in such manner as to meet the requirements of 3.5, which I'm guessing is some kind of a chart. The author goes on to say, after mixing these ingredients, you're ready to bake. Back to the Pentagon. A predetermined weight of blended fruitcake batter sufficient to yield the specified weight shall then be deposited into cans with liners and discs, and the lids of the cans shall be clinched on loosely to allow for the escape of moisture and gases evolved during processing. Alternatively, in lieu of paper, disc, and liner, the can shall have an enamel interior possessing adequate product release characteristics so that not more than 5.0% by weight of the product adheres to the interior of the can. Sealing and baking shall be so that the batter portion is heated uniformly throughout to produce a finished product having no raw, stringy, or ungelatinized portions. Lutz goes on. Now for the moment of truth. Quote, when the cooled product is bisected vertically and horizontally with a sharp knife, it shall not crumble nor show any compression streaks, gummy centers, soggy areas, be excessively dry or overprocessed, and shall display an even grain structure throughout. The specifications conclude with the bewildering requirement that the finished product should, another quote, conform to the inside contour of the can or can liner, with no point on the top lid greater than 3/4 of an inch from the side of the can where the cake did not touch the lid during baking, unquote. About the only thing left out of these specifications is who gets to lick the bowl and who gets to clean up the kitchen. If this is what it takes to bake a fruitcake for the Pentagon, how would you like to see the specifications for a new aircraft carrier? Why have mil-specs grown so dramatically in the last few decades? Well, there is a theory that holds that all those officers have to do something, since there aren't enough enlisted men to keep the officers busy. You see, of the 12,055,884 men and women on active duty in the U.S. Armed Forces in July 1945, 1,260,109 were officers, or one officer for every nine enlisted personnel. However, on May 31st, 1983, there were 2,114,341 enlisted personnel, of whom 293,026 were officers, or one officer for every six enlisted personnel. Some critics have suggested that the officer corps has become a self-perpetuating bureaucracy, preoccupied with making work for itself by systematically overcomplicating every aspect of defense. What better way to keep all of those officers busy than by writing all those pages of specifications? Then again, it may just be the nature of the military to make everything more complicated.
I don't like euphemistic language, you know, words that shade the truth. American English is packed with euphemism because Americans have trouble dealing with reality. And in order to shield themselves from it, they use soft language. And somehow it gets worse with every generation. Here's an example. There's a condition in combat that occurs when a soldier is completely stressed out and is on the verge of nervous collapse. In World War I, it was called shell shock. Simple, honest, direct language. Two syllables. Shell shock. It almost sounds like the guns themselves. That was more than 80 years ago. Then a generation passed, and in World War II, the same combat condition was called battle fatigue. Four syllables now. Takes a little longer to say. Doesn't seem to hurt as much. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock. Battle fatigue. By the early 1950s, the Korean War had come along, and the very same condition was being called operational exhaustion. The phrase was up to eight syllables now, and any last traces of humanity had been completely squeezed out of it, like something that might happen to your car. Then, barely 15 years later, we got into Vietnam, and thanks to the deceptions surrounding that war, it's no surprise that the very same condition was referred to as post-traumatic stress disorder. Still eight syllables, but we've added a hyphen. And the pain is completely buried under jargon. Post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll bet if they'd have been calling it shell shock, some of those Vietnam veterans might have received the attention they needed. But it didn't happen. And one of the reasons is that soft language. The language that takes the life out of life. And somehow, it keeps getting worse.
Hey everybody, this is Brett.
Today is July 16th, 2011, and the first part in a short series called Discovering Doublespeak.
First of all, that word might be new to some of you, so let's talk about where it comes from first. In George Orwell's novel, 1984, there were two terms. One was doublethink, and the other one was newspeak. Now, doublethink was Orwell's word for a person who could hold two completely opposing ideas in his or her mind at the same time and totally believe both of them. Newspeak was the language used to express the ideas of doublethink, and we combine those two, and we get doublespeak, and it's very popular today. So, what is it? What are the attributes of doublespeak? Well, first of all doublespeak is language that pretends to communicate in a meaningful way, but it's actually deliberately designed to mislead, to distort reality, to make bad things seem good. That's what we're going to talk about today. To avoid or shift responsibility, to limit, conceal, corrupt, or prevent actual critical thought, and create a kind of blurry inconsistency between objective reality and language. In recent shows, especially the last Teachers Union show and the Osama bin Laden show, we've been talking a lot about logical fallacies. But logical fallacies imply that the person who is falling victim to this false logic is at least trying to think. Doublespeak is designed to prevent that from even happening. As I mentioned when I was talking about the history of the word, George Orwell used the term doublethink to illustrate the idea of a person who could hold two completely contradictory ideas at the same time and somehow believe both of them. Well, there's a big difference between thinking and believing. And I think that the real important aspect here of doublespeak is that it prevents thinking almost entirely, at least thinking about what's really important. It's also very good for narrowing or controlling debate, getting people to think, if they think at all, in a very, 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 very small box with a lot of important details that they're missing going on outside of it. So, we started out the show with a fun little example from our friends at the Pentagon as they try to bake a fruitcake. It takes them 20 pages of specifications to do so, and we can have a good couple of chuckles about that. By the way, who are they making fruitcake for? I've never heard of Army fruitcake. Anyway, well, I've never been in the Army, never really been too close with anyone in the Army, so I don't know, maybe Army fruitcake's very popular. It must be delicious with all the work that goes into it. What we heard in that passage that I read at the beginning of the show was two other forms of doublespeak that we're actually not going to discuss today. The first one kind of fits into what I would call jargon, specialized language used by a particular professional trade or hobby group. This specialized language is used in discourse with lay audiences, overly complex terms used to impress others, and gobbledygook. Many long, sophisticated words used in long, convoluted sentences to confuse the audience and hide the real issue of the discourse. It was actually also an example of the fourth kind of doublespeak, inflated language. Puffed up, important-sounding words used to give commonplace things and events an elevated or glowing appearance or importance. And when it comes to the military, you could see how their logistical or their internal operations could become so confused and so complex when we remember that that entire modern organization is built on and maintained almost entirely by deception. But who are you really trying to get one over on by making a 20-page manual for a fruitcake? Like, who are you trying to fool with that? So what I'm saying is, like, that just becomes their culture, right? It's a culture of confusion and people being misled and things being overcomplicated, because you need to build up all of this language on top of truth, and I guess that's just a practice that bleeds into all aspects of their operation. It's certainly true in their procurement practices, which is when they, like, they buy stuff. I'm going to go back to the book and read another passage. This is just a couple pages beyond the whole fruitcake thing. One important function of doublespeak is to hide reality, to cover up what's really going on. With doublespeak, weapons never fail, and expensive items are always very complicated and worth their high price. Sometimes military doublespeak doesn't even give you the faintest idea of what the Pentagon is paying all that money for. In Pentagon doublespeak, it's not a plain, ordinary steel nut. It's a, quote, hexaform rotatable surface compression unit, which is why it costs $2,043 for just one of them. This book was written over 20 years ago, so who knows what a hexaform rotatable surface compression unit costs today. This little piece of doublespeak also allows you to say that the equipment, quote, suffered dramatically degraded useful operational life owing to the fact that a $2,000 hexaform rotatable surface compression unit underwent catastrophic stress-related shaft detachment. Which sounds a lot more impressive than saying it won't work because a 13-cent nut broke.
You may call it a flashlight, but the Air Force calls it an emergency exit light, which is why it costs $214. Some penny pinchers may say that $31,672 is a lot to pay for a couch, a love seat, and 20 dining room chairs, or almost $1,500 for each piece of furniture. But not if you think of it the way the Navy does. All of that money was spent on habitability improvements. For the destroyer USS Kidd, the ship must be really habitable after that high-priced improvement.
But it would be nice if doublespeak was just funny all the time. But that's not the case. It's often very tragic and very deadly. The first kind of doublespeak, in addition to jargon, gobbledygook, and inflated language, is the euphemism. If you're unfamiliar with that term, a euphemism is any word that attempts to soften, hide, or distort reality by putting the thing described into a better light, making the object it describes sound less frightening, less threatening, or less offensive. Inside the military, there are plenty of examples of euphemisms. Many of those have leaked out to the public. Like when a bomb goes off in a city and a bunch of people lie painfully, still drawing breath, in a pile of rubble to avoid that cold and prickly feeling that comes with using clear and accurate language, you would call them interdictional non-succumbers. In fact, the word bomb itself may bring up several images of death and destruction. So why call it a bomb when you could call it a vertically deployed anti-personnel device? When things go wrong, as in the case of Pat Tillman, he wasn't murdered by fellow soldiers. He was the unfortunate victim of an accidental delivery of ordnance equipment. The civilians who die, the mothers who lose their children, the children who lose their parents, the husbands who lose their wives, can all be summed up with the nice and neat phrase, collateral damage. You see, it's all part of total war, terrorism, war on civilians. Oh, wait, that's not what it's called. I meant to say eroding the will of the population. Doesn't that sound better? So the military very much has its own internal language to remove the horror and the humanity from what they do. It's not like they're killing people. They're just servicing targets. Most people are probably unfamiliar with many of these phrases. But there is one euphemism related to the military that is very, very popular and very, very dangerous. And that word is defense. In my opinion, using the word defense as an umbrella term for all actions of the military is one of the most thoughtless, irresponsible, and catastrophic practices in the civilized world. I said earlier that the goal of doublespeak, the intention of doublespeak, is to preemptively strike down thought and debate. The thoughts and debates that should have occurred for people in this country prior to U.S. interventions in Korea, Vietnam, Central America, Panama, Lebanon, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Iraq again. Those debates never happen because the word defense, it's not up for debate. Sure, war has such an aggressive connotation and might conjure up all kinds of grisly images for people, but defense, that's like protection. Who could be against that? The government seemed to have this mastered by 1949 when they changed the name of the accurately titled Department of War to the Department of Defense. And throughout the 20th century, using the word defense as a cover for the actual aggression of the military, the United States was able to vastly expand an empire. They were able to force relationships with compliant dictators happy to suppress their population to allow the United States to extract resources from those places. And at this point, a new euphemism enters our language. National interest. Anytime any conflict goes on, anywhere in the world, pretty much, it threatens U.S. national interests because the U.S. is an empire. So we don't use language like jeopardizing the stability of the empire. We say national interest because the nation, that's all of us, and our interests need to be protected. And today, in defense of national interests, the United States military does not invade other countries. They do preemptive strikes. You can see how this perpetuates itself. In the winter 1987-1988 edition of Propaganda Review, Noam Chomsky wrote an article entitled Propaganda American Style. I want to read a little bit of it. Pointing to the massive amounts of propaganda spewed by government and institutions around the world, observers have called our era the Age of Orwell. But the fact is that Orwell was a latecomer on the scene. As early as World War I, American historians offered themselves to President Woodrow Wilson to carry out the task they called, quote, historical engineering, by which they meant designing the facts of history so they would serve state policy. In this instance, the United States government wanted to silence opposition to the war. This represents a version of Orwell's 1984, even before Orwell was writing. In 1921, the famous American journalist Walter Lippmann said that the art of democracy requires what he called the, quote, manufacture of consent. This phrase is an Orwellian euphemism for thought control. The idea is that in a state such as the U.S., where government can't control the people by force, it had better control what they think. The Soviet Union is at the opposite end of the spectrum from us in its domestic freedoms. It's essentially a country run by the bludgeon. It's very easy to determine what propaganda is in the USSR. What the state produces is propaganda. That's the kind of thing Orwell described in 1984. Chomsky inserts, not a very good book in my opinion. 1984 is so popular because it's trivial and it attacks our enemies. If Orwell had dealt with a different problem, ourselves, his book wouldn't have been so popular. In fact, it probably wouldn't have been published. In totalitarian societies where there's a ministry of truth, propaganda doesn't really try to control your thoughts. It just gives you the party line. It says, here's the official doctrine, don't disobey and you won't get in trouble. What you think is not of great importance to anyone. If you get out of line, we'll do something to you because we have force. Democratic societies can't work like that. Unfortunately, you know, Chomsky wrote this over 20 years ago and we're seeing a lot more of that in this country today. Democratic societies can't work like that because the state is much more limited in its capacity to control behavior by force. Since the voice of the people is allowed to speak out, those in power better control what that voice says. In other words, control what people think. One of the ways to do this is to create political debate that appears to embrace many opinion, but actually stays within very narrow margins. So, back to what I was saying, this is the mission of doublespeak accomplished. You have to make sure that both sides in the debate accept certain assumptions, and that those assumptions are the basis of the propaganda system. As long as everyone accepts the propaganda system, the debate is permissible. The Vietnam War is a classic example of America's propaganda system. In the mainstream media, the New York Times, CBS, and so on, there was a lively debate about the war. It was between people called doves and people called hawks. The hawks said, if we keep at it, we can win. The dove said, even if we keep at it, it would probably be too costly for use, and besides, maybe we're killing too many people. Both sides agreed on one thing. We have the right to carry out aggression against South Vietnam. Doves and hawks alike refused to admit that aggression was taking place. They both called our military presence in Southeast Asia the defense of South Vietnam, substituting defense for aggression in the standard Orwellian manner. In reality, we were attacking South Vietnam just as surely as the Soviets later attacked Afghanistan.
So as Chomsky points out, taking a word that is consistent with objective reality, in the case of Vietnam, like aggression, and instead putting in defense, halts all kinds of potential debate. The euphemism defense is at the top of a pyramid of various types of propaganda. If you think about how we learn about the military and warfare in school, what the media show us, there's all of these smaller components, all of these foundational pieces that lead up to accepting outright, just blatant aggression as some kind of public service. Adolf Hitler once said, make the lie big, make it simple, keep saying it, and eventually they will believe it. This has actually been shown to be pretty successful, but I don't think it's that simple. Like I said, I think it requires a foundation of other types of propaganda. But the euphemism is very powerful. Like, some words, for most people, seem to require no follow-up examination. Defense, security, democracy, freedom. These words are like thought stoppers. Or thought regulators, thought governors. It's been said on the show before, our thoughts often become our words, but our words often become our thoughts. And you know me, I've gotten myself involved in a debate here and there, where I walked away not even sure if I had been speaking the same language as the other people involved. And you know why I felt like that, I've realized, in retrospect? It's because we weren't speaking the same language. Okay, when we're using the word defense, and I close my eyes, and I picture all kinds of hideous aggression, funded by the threat of aggression, and the person on the other side of the debate closes their eyes, and they picture a group of brave men stopping Hitler from launching V-2 rockets at the United States in 1944, followed by a parade, that discussion's not going anywhere. You see, here's the thing. Productive discussion, constructive dialogue and debate cannot even begin until all parties involved come to a mutual understanding of the grammar of the subject or the controversy. Now, grammar is part of something that we've talked a little bit about on the show in the past, and we're going to talk a lot more about in the future, the trivium method. Now, trivium is very similar to the idea of classical education, of actually being educated. And perhaps most importantly, having the skill set necessary for self-education and intellectual self-defense. Right, if we think about being a self-teacher or knowledge acquisition in general, like a trip to the grocery store, right? It sounds pretty straightforward. You think about what you want, and you go and you gather it up, and you find a way to obtain it. But when it comes to information, especially politics, in our educational experiences, in the media, imagine that trip to the supermarket where half the items have been poisoned. Well, this has become a bit more of a challenge, and we can see that another skill set has to come into play. So spotting these rhetorical tricks that are used by people who want to control the thought of others, that's just as important. In the world of today, in my opinion, it's just as important to have those skills. Actually being able to use your mind as a tool instead of just as a sponge. Grammar is the first part. That is the mechanics of language. logic deals with the mechanics of thought, and rhetoric is how that is turned around and used to teach or persuade others. But the foundation, grammar, the language, answering the basic questions, who, what, where, and when, there needs to be some consensus on that before debate can even enter into the picture. We're not even to the logic yet. We're not even to the why yet. And that's why doublespeak and euphemism is so powerful and so detrimental to the thinker or the person who's attempting to think. Because it lifts the burden of having to think for yourself at all. I call those words thought stoppers. They come with all kinds of presumptions and emotions already built into them. They're words that function as conclusions. So, what I believe, the job of a self-teacher, the job of an independent and critical thinker, is to detect doublespeak, especially the euphemism. It's to share it with others, and, of course, to explain it, to show examples of it, to hopefully use some of these examples or some examples of your own to demonstrate why that is so manipulative. Refuse to have debates with people until you can get on the same page as far as language is concerned. I've said this to people before in the past. What you call defense, I actually see as aggression. And you know, what you're calling defense doesn't fit my definition of, you know, an actual protective action in response to an aggressor. To me, what you're calling defense seems like a defense of the aggressor. So before we can go any further in this conversation and use words like national defense and Department of Defense and Secretary of Defense, we need to come back a little bit and maybe find a word that that both of us agree is accurate for this situation or this topic. But defense is not it for me. So I can't go forward. I can't go forward in this discussion if you're going to continue to use the word defense for what I see as aggression funded by the threat of aggression. I really feel like we need to get our what's in order here before we can go on to the why's. That's how a meaningful discussion could actually take place. Now, if you want to start trying this out, see how it works, you know, give me some feedback on problems that you have or successes, this is a good time for that. Because we are currently in the period of time that occurs every 2 years and lasts for 2 years called the presidential campaign, where there's a lot of doublespeak going on. So, on the topic of politics, the people that you might talk to probably have their feet planted somewhere, right? They probably have some kind of political bias. And of course, in the world of politics, which is win-lose interactions, those people with their feet planted on one side of the spectrum and all the biases that come with it, they have political enemies. Now, like I said, doublespeak is everywhere. Both sides of the spectrum engage in doublespeak almost constantly. Really, like, I prepared for this show by, I was thinking about including some clips from the recent presidential debates, the State of the Union address, or a few State of the Union addresses from the past. I was overwhelmed. I couldn't even keep up. It's nonstop. If it wasn't for doublespeak, these people wouldn't be saying anything. Doublespeak is the sound a politician makes when they move their tongue and their lips and blow air out of their face. It's all they do. There is no sincerity. There is no clear language. There is no language or rhetoric that is respectful of the intellect of the audience. So, you would have plenty of examples to show this other person of doublespeak. And they'd be far more open to understanding this if it was coming from their political opponents. Oh yeah, that's really insincere. You could probably also show them a clip of their political heroes doing the same thing. But however you do it, I mean, and first of all, pointing it out, detecting it, and pointing it out to others, I think is most important. But then ask the question.
What does it say? What does it say about an organization or the people who populate it when they have to craft an entire dialect of English composed of unclear and insincere language? What does that say about them or what they do? And if you are in school, and I guess, you know, it all comes back to school, right? This is where we learn to sit there and passively absorb this euphemistic language from authorities about our country, about our government, about the authorities themselves, including the people in the school. I mean, we have this institution funded by the threat of aggression against homeowners that takes children under the threat of a penalty of truancy and makes them sit in these desks for 12 years while they learn mostly things that they could care less about, wasting their time, stealing their life, feeding them unnecessary information or bad, dishonest, manipulative disinformation. And we call that education. That's not what education is, right? Education, if we break that word down, if we look at the etymology, it means to lead out. To lead out. What we have going on in these buildings today is essentially imprisonment, which is kind of the opposite. So if you're still in school, I mean, this is like, the more inundated you are with doublespeak, the easier it is to start finding examples of it, I think. This is a good time for that. Look at our media, like I said, these presidential elections, your own history classes. Discover doublespeak. Point it out to others. Explain it to them. Explain why people would want to use this kind of language. This understanding is one of the most important aspects of intellectual self-defense. This is one of the most important defensive tools to bring with you to the supermarket of poisoned food. Euphemisms are just the first part of doublespeak. And remember, doublespeak is just one aspect of propaganda. But hopefully today we've seen the destructive power of the euphemism. Because after the euphemisms are in place and they're accepted, all other forms, propaganda and doublespeak, can basically go unnoticed. I hope this has been helpful. Thank you for listening, and take care.
The mission in Iraq has been difficult and trying for our nation. But it is in the vital interest of the United States that we succeed. A free Iraq will deny Al-Qaeda a safe haven. A free Iraq will show millions across the Middle East that a future of liberty is possible. A free Iraq will be a friend of America, a partner in fighting terror, and a source of stability in a dangerous part of the world. By contrast, a failed Iraq would embolden the extremists, strengthen Iran, and give terrorists a base from which to launch new attacks on our friends, our allies, and our homeland. The enemy has made its intentions clear. At a time when the momentum seemed to favor them, Al-Qaeda's top commander in Iraq declared that they will not rest until they have attacked us here in Washington. My fellow Americans, we will not rest either. We will not rest until this enemy has been defeated. We must do the difficult work today so that years from now, people will look back and say that this generation rose to the moment, prevailed in a tough fight, and left behind a more hopeful region and a safer America.
See that train? 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 The midnight train runs both ways. See that train? The midnight train runs both ways. See that train? The midnight train runs both ways. See that train? The midnight train runs both ways.
Night train, switching your. Night train, switching your.